Hello and welcome. You're listening to Liberation Radio on Talk 860 WWDB Philadelphia.
En cuanto a la heroica y desdichada Venezuela, sus acontecimientos han sido tan rápidos y sus devastaciones tales.
With respect to heroic and hapless Venezuela, events there have moved so rapidly, and the devastation has been such that it is reduced to frightful desolation and almost absolute indigence. Nevertheless, it was once among the fairest regions that are the pride of America.
Simón Bolívar, September 6, 1815.
Breaking news tonight, sources telling Fox Business, thousands of separate demonstrations will be held tomorrow in Caracas.
This is desperate stuff. Venezuela's capital has no power to pump water.
Dozens of Venezuelans waiting for food.
Millions of people are expected to pour into the streets in a broad sweeping show of anti-Maduro protests.
The crisis in Venezuela is getting worse.
You're listening to Throughline from NPR.
Where we go back in time
to understand the present.
Hey, I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rand Abdel Fattah.
And on this episode,
the story of two leaders in Venezuela separated by nearly two centuries that shaped the country into what it is today. Venezuela is facing an economic and humanitarian crisis. A lot of the country is in extreme poverty, with no food in the supermarkets, very little gas at the pumps, blackouts almost daily, and the currency now pretty much worthless. In fact, things have gotten so bad that more than 3 million people have fled the country in recent years.
Making matters worse, the political situation is also really confusing, because as of January 23rd, Venezuela has two men claiming the presidency.
On that day, an opposition leader named Juan Guaido declared himself the legitimate president.
In opposition to the country's elected president, Nicolas Maduro.
And adding to the confusion is the fact that many countries, including the U.S., are now recognizing Guaido as Venezuela's president. But Maduro still has many supporters, including Venezuela's military, and he's holding his ground.
The question is, how did a country that was once the richest in South America end up here?
As we started looking into this question, it quickly became clear that Venezuela's problems began way before this standoff between Maduro and Guaido. It goes back to Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez.
What happened with Maduro cannot be isolated from what happened under Hugo Chavez.
Populist politics, socialism, and his own personality cult with blowtorch rhetoric.
He may be gone, but Hugo Chavez is far from forgotten.
Chavez created the regime that Maduro is now struggling to control. To understand Maduro and the current situation, you have to understand Chavez. But then we asked what motivated Chavez and what historical forces brought him to power. And the answer to that question takes us back to when Venezuela was created and a man named Simón Bolívar.
In the early 1800s, Bolívar helped free a bunch of countries in South America from Spanish colonial rule, earning him the nickname El Libertador, the Liberator.
His mythical story is at the core of Venezuela's story. It's been used again and again by leaders as a legitimizing force. Hugo Chavez was just the latest among these leaders. Chavez even named his movement the Bolivarian Revolution.
Their stories, Chavez and Bolívar, and the rise and fall of the Venezuela they ruled over, are strikingly similar and offer a window into the soul of a country that's been in a revolutionary cycle for centuries now.
Some believe that on his deathbed in 1830, Simón Bolívar's final words were,
"Damn it. How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?"
In the early hours of July 16th, 2010, at the northern edge of the old town of Caracas, Venezuela's capital, Hugo Chavez set out to free Bolívar from what Chavez had, in the past, called lies.
They tell us that Bolívar left government because he was sick with tuberculosis. Lies, lies, a thousand lies.
Chavez suspected foul play and wanted to check for himself whether Bolívar actually died from tuberculosis or something more sinister, like poison. So he decided to exhume the body of Bolivar.
And there's a whole lot of theater built around this moment.
Journalist Rory Carroll was there to witness it.
I was the Guardian's Latin America correspondent from 2006 until 2012, based in Caracas, Venezuela. And all this being recorded live.
On national television.
Un equipo de forenses venezolanos y españoles exhumaron los restos del libertador Simón Bolívar.
People were glued to the TV because this had been built up as the moment when the Bolivarian Revolution reconnects with its namesake beyond symbolism. That this is where the two bodies, the political body and the actual body of the revolutionary leader here and the revolutionary leader then, are going to connect.
This is Alejandro Velasco. He grew up in Venezuela and is now
an associate professor of history at New York University.
So with the country looking on, the entourage of politicians, soldiers, and scientists arrives at the National Pantheon. Decked out in white lab coats, hairnets, and ventilation masks, they enter a room with a casket in the middle.
Este proceso ha sido también en todo momento,
a handful of them then step towards the casket and lift up the lid. A Venezuelan flag covers the remains. After neatly folding up the flag, they remove the final layer. And there it is, a skeleton, the skeleton of Simón Bolívar.
Chavez looks into the camera, and you could tell that there's a physical reaction of goosebumps, call it, something happening there.
And he's giving the live commentary as the workers are, you know, digging up the crypt. And then his voice goes into this weird kind of like, hush, and aquí estamos, you know, con Bolívar, the espíritu de Bolívar.
Feeling the spirit of Bolívar sort of creeping into him.
He was hamming it up so much. I mean, it was funny, but it was surreal. It was creepy.
The coming of the liberator back into a certain kind of life.
Forget the Truman Show. This was the Hugo Chavez show.
Un hecho único que nos define como latinoamericanos.
El cráneo del libertador.
Que Bolívar también significa.
Uno de los hombres más grandes de la historia.
But as a Venezuelan, as somebody who grew up in Venezuela and, you know, had Bolívar's stories, field trips to Bolívar's childhood home, going to the sites of Bolívar's battles in Venezuela, I couldn't help but be also moved by that moment.
Sure, it was really good political theater, but scientifically, it was inconclusive. After the cameras were turned off, they packed Bolívar back up. And Chavez excitedly tweeted, yes, tweeted to the world, my God, I confess we have cried, we have sworn. This glorious skeleton must be Bolívar, because you can feel his ardor. Rise up, Simón, as it's not time to die. Immediately, I remembered that Bolívar lives.
It's 1803, and a young Simón Bolívar stands at his wife's deathbed, looking at her for the last time, the love of his life, María Teresa. What happens that day in 1803 would change Bolívar's life in South America forever. But first, let's go back to the beginning, to where his story started. Bolívar grew up in Caracas, in a really wealthy family.
One of the richest families in Latin America. It owned tobacco fields, it owned indigo fields.
And they also owned slaves. Despite that massive wealth, Bolívar's early years weren't all that easy.
His father died when he was very young.
His mother died not long after that. So by age 9...
he was an orphan.
This is Marie Arana. She's written a bunch of books on Latin America, including the biography Bolívar, American Liberator. So Bolívar, now orphaned, was passed around from relative to relative.
He was naughty. He didn't like the company of the aristocrats. He'd rather play in the fields with the slaves, and he did. He was basically rootless, really, until one of his uncles said, well, okay, let's send you to Madrid so you can get some manners.
He goes to Madrid, and it's there that he meets his future wife, María Teresa. Like Bolivar,
she also came from an aristocratic family, and in the way that these things happened at the time, it wasn't so much that it was prearranged, but that they were part of Criollo elite.
Criollo is a term for people of mixed European and Afro-Caribbean descent. Both Bolivar and Maria Teresa were from the upper class, so they rolled in the same social circles.
And they sprung a romance that, by all accounts, was very genuine.
They got married,
returned to Venezuela, settled into a life on Bolivar's family plantation, and began the rest of their life together. All in all, they were happy. But less than a year after their wedding,
she became ill. I can't remember exactly what...
With yellow fever.
That's right, yellow fever. But it struck her very rapidly, and so she died very quickly after.
Bolivar was left devastated.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was destroyed.
Some historians believe if Maria Teresa had not died, Bolivar might never have gotten involved in the fight for independence. Bolivar himself said...
He said if she hadn't died, he would have been a very successful landowner. He would have, potted around his properties and, had children and had a very, very much the same sort of life that his father and his grandparents and his great-grandparents had.
A relatively quiet life in the country. But having just lost his wife, Bolivar began to search for a new purpose in life. So fast forward a few years. Bolivar is now in Paris, still depressed over the loss of his wife, still searching for a clear path forward, drinking a lot, womanizing. And while there, he witnessed a rebellious fervor taking over France. This was the era of the French Revolution, of Napoleon, of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Meanwhile, the fight for independence was ramping up in Venezuela. At that time, Venezuela and most of South America was still a colony of the Spanish Empire.
The coincidence of history and personal tragedy and larger history is significant because this was also right around the time that Francisco de Miranda, who was the principal architect of a vision of liberation for Venezuela, was trying desperately to rile up the Criollo elite to declare independence.
And keep in mind, Bolivar was from one of the most elite families in Venezuela. Eventually, he decides to team up with Francisco de Miranda. But initially, Bolivar is not all that central to this movement.
His initial role was primarily as the scion of a Criollo elite family, very much on the sidelines.
Basically, he has money, and his presence is good PR for the movement. In 1810, Bolivar's status suddenly changes. He and Miranda stage an uprising against the Spanish, and catching the Spanish off guard, take Caracas. Venezuela formally declares independence in 1811. But then, in 1812, a massive earthquake hits Venezuela, and Spanish priests convince a superstitious population that the earthquake was divine retribution. So the Spanish are able to rally their troops, recapture important ports, and take back control of the country. Amid all this chaos, something unexpected happens. Bolivar, along with a few rebel generals, figure out that Miranda has been trying to broker a deal with the Spanish to end the war, effectively undermining the revolution. Disgusted by this betrayal, Bolivar decides that they should hand Miranda over to the Spanish. And in exchange, the Spanish agreed to let Bolivar go. But he's banished from Venezuela and sent into exile. The revolution has been shut down, for the moment. But by singling him out, the Spanish helped manufacture a new image of Bolivar as the natural replacement for Miranda.
Here's this tiny man. He weighed all of 120 pounds. He had no chest to speak of. He was spindly. He was
in a sort of accident of history. This guy is now the face of the revolution. But it turns out, Bolivar actually had the traits of a serious leader.
He would walk into a room, and larger, taller people would be dwarfed, really, by his presence, because he was so dynamic, friendly, the sort of warm personality that inspired people.
After this first failed revolution, Bolivar is no longer on the sidelines. He's now at the center of the movement. And there, his desire for change will only intensify.
February the 4th, 1992, and normal programming on Venezuelan TV was interrupted by this unfolding story.
It's 1992.
A press conference is announced very hastily.
TV crews with microphones get in position. And then...
out comes the president.
Carlos Andrés Pérez, followed by the Minister of Defense.
And then this man, who none of us knew. And the president said, no, this is Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez. He has some words. And then he spoke for 2 minutes.
Y en la Brigada Blindada de Valencia.
2 minutes. Actually, a little less than 2 minutes. Point is, not a long time. Before I tell you what Chavez said in that speech, let me first explain how he ended up there. In roughly 2 minutes. So Chavez was born in 1954 in a part of Venezuela called Los Llanos.
The equivalent of the U.S. kind of Wild West, of these big rolling plains.
One of 6 kids.
They were very, very poor.
Raised mostly by his grandmother. He was mestizo, mixed race, with African and indigenous roots. And by all accounts, a happy, outgoing kid with a wild imagination.
Imbibing the legends of headless horsemen, of love stories, of the cowboys, of the plains.
He had dreams of becoming a professional baseball player until reality set in. In his early 20s, Chavez joined the Venezuelan army, one of the fastest ways to move up the social ladder. While there,
he got inspired by some leftist Latin American generals who took a more reform approach to their societies in contrast with the right-wing military dictatorships in much of Latin America.
Above all, he was inspired by one guy, Simón Bolívar.
I'll talk about that. We want to wait a minute because there's a police siren going by.
By the way, this is Jennifer McCoy. She's a professor of political science at Georgia State University.
Okay, I'm back. Simón Bolívar is...
Simón Bolívar is a hero to Chavez, someone he saw as a real trailblazer, a champion for the people, who uprooted the political order. For most of the 20th century, which was the backdrop for Chavez's life, the political order of Venezuela was based around one thing, oil.
Oil was everything. Was and remains in Venezuela is everything because its economy almost hinges entirely on oil.
In the 1920s, Venezuela became a major oil producer. The economy boomed, and eventually the oil industry was nationalized. Venezuela seemed to be a beacon of stability and prosperity.
In a region otherwise ravaged by civil wars and dictatorships.
Through the 50s, 60s, 70s. Problem was, most of that wealth was concentrated in the hands of a few at the top. And in the 1980s, oil prices began to drop, and the economy began to decline. The gap between rich and poor got bigger, and corruption in the government was rampant. That's when Chavez began to think seriously about staging his own uprising. So he got a bunch of his friends in the military together and formed a group called the Revolutionary Bolivarian Army, determined to lift up the poor by spreading the oil wealth around and championing a sort of deeper democracy. For a few years, they plotted, planned, and by 1992, the pieces were set. They were going to overthrow the president of Venezuela.
An attempted coup was taking place on the streets of Caracas.
Here's how it went down. On the morning of February 4th, 5 military units were dispersed across the country. Their mission? To take over key government posts. The defense ministry, the military airport, the military museum, the presidential palace, and the national TV station, where they planned to broadcast a video
on the part of Chavez and other of the leaders of this movement, calling on the population to rise up. I remember, you know, my mother turning on the television.
The men in the red berets are rebel paratroopers.
And, you know, it was those things that you kind of see in movies, like a grainy video of people, you know, in fatigues, speaking about the conditions of significant inequality that existed and that something has to change.
Some of the military units quickly took control of a few large cities in Venezuela. But the unit led by Chavez, the one that was supposed to take over the presidential palace in Caracas and arrest the president...
That coup was a military fiasco. He failed. And eventually they surrendered.
Okay, bizarre twist here. So Chavez, who failed in his mission, is then chosen by the president to make a speech on national television, mainly because he was the rebel leader who happened to be at the presidential palace, Right place, right time.
He is one of at least six or seven other people who could have taken up that role of prominent leadership. And it falls on Chavez because he is given airtime to tell all the other troops who had actually been successful in their own tactical missions to lay down their weapons.
This was supposed to be his punishment, to go on TV and wave a white flag, admit defeat, for 2 minutes.
I take responsibility for the failure of this project. And then he also said this is a Bolivarian movement.
We were fighting for democracy. We haven't achieved it right now, but it's just over
por ahora.
For the moment.
Which created the expectation that this was not the end, this was the beginning.
When this outsider emerged, first trying to stage a coup which failed, but then publicly recognizing that that failure was his own and accepting responsibility, that was something new for most Venezuelans.
This is Raul Gallegos. He was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Caracas from 2004 to 2009.
So he became a star.
That was his 30 seconds of fame. That's when he burst onto the world stage.
And that was all that it took to completely alter the narrative of Venezuelan history.
After giving the speech, Chavez was escorted to jail, which only added to his newfound stardom.
And so in failure, he nevertheless became the leader because of this circumstance.
Another accident of history.
If somebody else had been, you know, given that airtime, maybe they would have been the ones to lead this movement. And to a large extent, that had also happened with Bolívar, right? In both cases, it was out of failure and circumstance that that propelled their image as something larger. And then they kind of rode that image into bigger and better things.
Well, not always better, but without a doubt, much bigger things were just around the corner for both of them. Part 2, The Iron Hand.
So last we heard of Bolívar, he'd just been sent into exile after a failed attempt at Venezuelan independence. And it was during that time that Bolívar's revolutionary vision really took shape.
Most people at the time, you know, they never got beyond like 50 miles or radius, and he just traveled everywhere, certainly by necessity, but also, you know, by choice.
Bolívar spent a lot of time outside of Venezuela, organizing new rebellions, failing, and reflecting on what went wrong in that first rebellion, the one that came so close to succeeding. Those reflections led Bolívar to devise a whole new approach. First, if he wanted to build up an army, all types of people needed to be brought into the revolutionary fold, not just, as Miranda had thought, the elite, the criollos.
Criollos aren't going to, you know, be the ones who are charging into battle. People who are going to be charging into battle are mestizo, you know, mixed race peoples who can imagine themselves in a better place in an independent system. It's slaves for whom he subsequently promises liberty.
Second, Bolívar decided that he would have to wage a different kind of war to stand a chance against the powerful Spanish army.
He was one of the original guerrilla fighters because he was all about surprise and all about numbers. So even though you were naked in a loincloth with nothing but a stick, you know, if you had enough of those people, you could run over a battalion of Spanish with better armor.
And third, Bolívar rethought his mission altogether.
This can't be a struggle to liberate Venezuela. This has to be a much larger continental struggle.
He imagined a South America under one flag that would be democratic and inclusive of all the diverse people that lived in it. This wasn't just an effort to take power. It was supposed to bring a different kind of government, one not just ruled by the elite. He called this new vision of a united South America
Gran Colombia, Great Colombia.
Es una idea grandiosa,
pretender formar de todo el mundo nuevo una sola nación con un solo vínculo,
which would bring together a federation of independent republics nevertheless united as one.
Debería por consiguiente tener un solo gobierno que reúna los diferentes estados que hayan de formarse en la confederación.
More and more people across South America began joining his cause, and with this army, Bolívar began challenging Spanish troops in Venezuela and neighboring Colombia. But it wouldn't be an easy path to independence.
The Spanish were a force, unbelievable force. Very, very violent and very organized military structure.
But then, in 1819, Bolívar's army marched towards Colombia. And Bolívar knew if they followed a typical route, the Spanish would defeat them again. So instead, he decided to take a less predictable but ridiculously dangerous route through the Andes Mountains.
It's cold. It's rocky. It's mountainous. Horses don't easily, you know, pass through there. It's uncharted terrain.
Hoping that the element of surprise would carry them to victory.
When these armies traveled, and we need to remember this, it wasn't just soldiers. They traveled with their women, because they, you know, the women were cooking for the men right on the battlefield. They were bringing their children. So you would have these great long trains and caravans of people going into war, which were like whole populations.
For weeks, this caravan of soldiers, women, and children trudged through the mountains. Some people got sick, others died. But eventually, the army arrived in Boyaca, a town in central Colombia about 90 miles from the capital, Bogotá.
They come upon a battalion of Spaniards who did not think that the Bolívar's army, again comprised of these people, would take that route.
And Bolívar's army won their first major victory.
Bolívar needed a victory at that time to be able to turn the tide and to gain some momentum.
And the Spanish finally began to look beatable, no longer an invincible force. And within a couple of years, Gran Colombia was declared a reality as Bolívar set his sights on liberating the rest of Spanish South America. And Bolívar became the first president of Gran Colombia.
Liberation Radio is sponsored by historic St. George's United Methodist Church in Philadelphia. If you want to stay in touch or get involved, you can like us on Facebook or follow our Instagram. Or you can call us at 215-925-7780.